The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood. I'm the director of climate strategy company Resilience Limited. And Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Well, we've got a treat today. We've got the first of three episodes where I enjoy a discussion with well-known freshwater ecologist Dr. Mike Joy. We split it over three. We chatted for nearly an hour and we covered all sorts of stuff. Freshwater was really only a little bit of what we covered. So I do hope you enjoy it as much as I did. It's lovely to welcome Dr. Mike Joy to Climate Matters. Greetings, Mike, and thank you so much for joining us for a conversation that I'm really looking forward to.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Lindsay. I'm looking forward to it too.
You need a little introduction to our listeners, I'm sure, because you're well known as a tireless warrior for freshwater quality and as a seasoned campaigner for wider climate issues. In fact, I love it that you're so willing to put your head above the trenches when a lot of people kept their heads down. Even so, your CV is both interesting and impressive and bears some repeating. You came late to academia and first you tackled an amazing array of jobs, working as everything from being Mike Joy milk vendor, I love the story about the kids riding the trolleys down the hill, to active duty in the SIS, to working in the Aussie Outback and a whole heap more. Then at the tender age of 33, you entered Massey University and the realm of freshwater ecology. And it seemed to me, and that came out in your great autobiography, The Fight for Freshwater. I recommend that to listeners. It seemed to me that freshwater ecology, you'd found your calling there. You emerged with a PhD and headed into an academic career, which has seen you not only conducting great science, but also being in and out of the public eye en route to what's your present position as a senior research fellow at Victoria University. That's a great CV, Mike. It also gives us lots of potential starting points for our conversation. So just as a warm-up, projects are you engaged with at present that you'd be happy to share with listeners?
Yeah, I've got lots of things going on. Right here and now, I'm in the middle of writing a little 10-minute talk that I've got to give to the junior Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting here in Wellington tomorrow. So these school kids from around New Zealand take on the roles as heads of government from these countries and come together for a big meeting. So I'm talking to them. I've got lots happening with the changes to freshwater and the RMA. So I'm doing some work with Environmental Law Initiative, Environmental Defence Society, hopefully going to get a submission prepared on that for the New Zealand Ecological Society as well that I'm a member of. So they're all kind of overlapping with some research for legal cases that I'm taking around the proposed changes to freshwater. So yeah, kind of slap in the middle of a lot of my work is interestingly being writing evidence these days for court cases.
Wow.
And it looks like it's the way it's going with the climate stuff as well, you know, with lawyers for climate action. And it seems like that's where we get pretty much ignored everywhere else and the science gets ignored. And then we take a legal case and suddenly what we do maybe has some significance and maybe gets used. You know, that's where I'm at. I mean, I spent a huge amount of time recently preparing evidence for the Ngāi Tahu versus the Crown case in the High Court, and that's being decided at present. So that's kind of where my research is going these days, is writing evidence.
Wow, but that's really on your toes stuff too, isn't it? Because every word becomes charged with meaning and open to being unpicked by the opposition and so on. I admire you for doing that. Yeah. And I've also heard people talk about this era as death by submission, and it feels a bit like it to me sometimes. And the way you're talking has that feel about it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I kind of, you know, in the back of my mind, I think it's really important work, but But having been involved in the process with the National Policy Statement 2020 and being, you know, sort of inside MFE at the time on the technical advisory group and seeing just how those, when you get a load of submissions coming in like that, they either, well, I guess they probably use AI now, but back a few years ago, they employed, you know, graduate students to just come in and put the submissions into different piles, you know, and it's so frustrating. So much work goes into these things and they're very unlikely to be even read. But I guess the process means that the people who are making the submissions are much more aware of what's going on. So there is a positive side to it in that submission writing.
Yes, you're right. I'm sure you. I mean, I haven't been involved at the level that you work, but I've submitted often enough to government and council. And on the one hand, you feel like it's like dropping a stone down the well. You don't know if you'll even hear a splash. On the other hand, I feel for the people on the receiving end. You know, a council gets 400 submissions on something.
Yeah.
And how the hell do they make sense of it, even if they have to look like they're making sense of it?
Yes, totally. Yeah.
Oh, well, good luck with that. Do you ever get a feeling that those processes are sometimes more about damage control than they are about getting good legislation or policy out of them?
Oh, maybe I'm even more cynical than that it's just a box-ticking exercise they have to go through. They love to talk about, you know, community engagement and getting feedback. But I suspect they know exactly what they want to do and they're just going to go ahead and do it. And this is just something you have to do along the way. So, you know, but again, I think the process and the people getting off their bums and writing these things makes them have to think about it more and become more aware. And so I don't write off the process because that's the positive side of it. Even if the officials never read it, it's being involved that makes a difference.
A sort of consciousness raising exercise to some degree.
Exactly.
No, that's a good point. However, it's not going to take me long to segue off track here, Mike.
No, go for it.
There's quite a lot of talk around about other forms of citizen participation, you know, participatory democracy and citizens' assemblies and so on. And in fact, you live on the Kapiti Coast and Porirua had a really interesting example earlier this year. Have you had any experience with citizens' assemblies or have you got any views of how those sort of processes might help raise the level of decision-making in these sort of areas?
You know, I mean, I was just thinking about the experience that I had was probably close to 10 years ago. There was a citizens' assembly assembled in Wellington and I was asked to come along and be a panel at, and Nicola Wills was... she was a councillor at the time, Wellington councillor at the time, and was on the panel with me. So things have changed a bit since then. So, I think that it's a really important part of how we might change things in the future is the power of citizens' assemblies. Sort of we're to get away from this thing where we're ending up, whatever you want to call it at the moment, feels like a dictatorship almost. And so the further we can get away from that, the better, I think.
I was in a group one time when we were doing a consultation and one of the guys just threw his pen down and said, "This feels more like insultation than consultation."
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, look, moving on, a couple of days ago, you sent me a link to a great article by Rachel Donald, and it was called We're Collectively Suffering Through a Crisis of Imagination. What prompted you to send me? I mean, I could guess why you sent it, but I'd like to hear from you.
I have been interviewed by Rachel before, and I've discussed it with her, but I've been on about the crisis of imagination for a long time before this article came out, and I can't remember if I've kind of if in discussions with you I've talked about this idea, but when I try to make sense of where we are, I've thought about this analogy of being an Egyptian and living in Egypt after the last.
No, you've never shared that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I was just thinking. Okay, so
go for it.
So there's four big pyramids, and I'm really talking about something I know nothing about, but I do know there's four big pyramids, and at some point they stopped making pyramids, and the history and the historians will tell us that the basically the whole Egyptian economy was tied up in building pyramids up until that point. So so everyone, if I was an Egyptian at that time, everyone, I would be involved in it. Everyone I know and my family and my parents and grandparents would have all been involved in building pyramids. Everyone would have, you know, pyramids would have been it. And at some point, somebody says, right, we're not making pyramids anymore. And you're just like,
pyramid.
Yeah. And you're like, what do you mean? I can't imagine a life without pyramids, you know, because that's all I've ever known. That is my life. And so that's where I feel that we are now, is the crisis is that people can't imagine a life that isn't like us. And this is why we cling to every possible, you know, the things that I go on about, the delusions of net zero, the delusion of replacing everything with renewable energy, all of those kind of things that we really go out of our way to believe, because we can't imagine a world that isn't like this. And for some of us, and this is where I think I've been really lucky, and not everybody's had this opportunity, but I always keep coming back to that couple of months that I spent down on Campbell Island, you know, without any technology whatsoever, and that realization for me that has helped me break out of that crisis of imagination, because I can imagine a world without all that stuff, because I did live in it for a wee while, and so yes. You know, I think that's maybe what makes a difference for me.
No, that makes complete sense, and there's a, you know, I'm a real fan of that we need more imagination too. In my younger days, I used to do a lot of mountaineering, and one of my heroes was a mountaineer who was a little bit older than me, Art Vervoorn. Art, if you're listening, because he lives in Tasman, you may not know this story, but he, in the days when I was climbing, it was considered pretty dubious if you solo climbed on your own without a mate on a rope and things like that, but Art did a lot of that. And one time he was being interviewed or something, and people said, well, you know, haven't you had any accidents or anything? And his answer was, far too many people come to grief through lack of imagination. In other words, not thinking where they're going to go and equipping themselves to be ready for it. And that's a similar thing. And did you know Nick Agar? I don't think he's in Victoria anymore, but he was.
No, I know the name, but I don't think I've met him. No.
I remember hearing a talk by him called Imagination Insurance, and he was saying, we ought to use our imagination to look at what might lie ahead as a way of getting insurance policy to equip ourselves for what it is.
So, yeah, I think that maybe some people, yeah, I don't know if this is the same thing, but I was talking to a friend recently about flying. I learned to fly years ago. But what I used to do, and I assumed that everybody could do this, I just remember during the training time, if I wasn't flying, if I was lying in bed at night or whatever, I could picture in my head every part of that plane, every, you know. So I could just go through all of the checks and things in my head and just do it over and over and over again. And I just assumed that everyone could do that. But the friend that I was talking to, who's also doing pilot training, said she cannot do that at all. And it made me think about, you know, maybe, you know, that variation within, with the imagination that's within people, might be part of the explanation as well, whether you just have that ability or not.
It could be, or something to do with the neuro pathways that you've got developed in your head or something. Fascinating story. That's great. Gosh, I enjoyed that conversation, and I'm so glad there's more to come. Thank you, Mike, for the first of those sessions. Really good. Just before we carry on, I just want to remind listeners that with the lead up to the local government elections, 3 years ago, Fresh FM broadcast a number of interviews that I conducted with climate specialists and other related fields all around the country. And well, I didn't interview around the country. They were from around the country, even from overseas. And these are quite pertinent to the coming local body elections. So just to give you an idea, I'm going to run through the people we interviewed. You can find links to all of these interviews on the Resilience website, www.resilience, R-E-S-I-L, ienz.co.nz. And then if you go follow the menu to the Climate Matters podcasts, and then there's a subsection of that Climate and Councils. We talked to Honourable James Shaw, and who was then Minister of Climate, and Professor Susan Crumdyke, an energy specialist in Scotland, and they set the scene. Dr. Olivia Hyatt and Meliana Stevens were discussing climate connects everything. Then we had Penny Molnar and Dr. Joanna Santa Barbara both discussing a just transition. We had the two Simons, Dr. Simon Stewart, another freshwater ecologist, and Simon Miller, who's the executive director of Pure Advantage. They were talking about regenerating nature. The late Rod Oram and Ali Boswick were talking about making our regional economy less vulnerable to climate. Then we had Sam Archer and Professor Rafe Chapman, who were both talking about climate and buildings and transport. We had a focus on energy with Emeritus Professor Pat Bodger, who was a specialist in the grid and power engineering. Professor James Renwick and Sophie Hanford visualizing the future and championing change. And then we have a wrap-up session with Professor Bronwyn Hayward under the heading Summing Up. What does all this mean? Terrific podcasts. They typically run for half an hour, sometimes with one person, sometimes with two. And I recommend them for you for this coming local body elections. Anyway, so that brings us to the end of this episode. And as you know, Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9. to Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson Tasman region on 104.8. It also streams to the planet on freshfm.co.nz, and podcasts of Climate Matters and other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz. And on that note, that's me signing off, thanking you very much for your company. I hope I enjoy it again next week for Climate Matters number 135. And then the week after, we'll be interview two with Mike Joy. And then 2 weeks after that, the third interview with Mike Joy. All the best. I look forward to you having your company again next week. And kia kaha for the climate.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.